Welcome to the show, and don't forget to check out this month's Nebula exclusive, Giant Space Monsters, as we explore everything from Space Kraken to giant sandworms. To get access and help support the show while hearing every episode early and ad-free, plus hours of bonus content, check out go.nebula.tv/IsaacArthur and use my code IsaacArthur.
We'll get started in just a moment, but go ahead and start getting your questions in the chat window so our moderators can start relaying those to me as soon as we start. Please try to keep the questions concise and watch your spelling, and try to be polite to others in the chat. We usually go for about an hour, so you probably want to grab a drink and a snack, though we'll take a break about halfway through, too. With all that said, welcome, and let's get started.
Good afternoon, everybody, and welcome to our live stream Q&A for April 2022. This occasion happens to commemorate the second year of my wife actually being our wonderful co-host for this thing. Here she is.
Hi.
As non-coincidentally, this is also our second anniversary, so while I normally say afterwards that I will be taking comments that you put in the questions or being them next day, you're welcome to put questions in the comments if we don't get to them today, but it will probably be a couple days before I get to them. Because we're pretty much leaving the live stream and going straight on vacation for a couple of days. So, with all that said, let's go ahead and get to your questions.
All right. Well, our first question is from Igor Briskin, and he wants to know if, besides nuclear steam rocket engines, what other options exist to travel the solar system quickly, like the New Expanse?
I think the big problem in terms of trying to do anything with fusion that we have right now is, of course, we don't actually have fusion yet. So, we can't really say what's going to work and what's not going to work for that. The idea behind the Epstein drive, I've never been entirely clear on. There's definitely the show and the official write-up in book one, but it is basically just a classic fusion torch drive, right? The notion there is that only with something as powerful as fission or fusion or antimatter can you get to go those speeds. But you can also do this if you got an exhaust velocity, that's the speed of light. But what do we have that would do that? Light, right? So that's why we so often talk about laser sails on the show, or light sails on the show. You use mirrors all over the solar system. If you can't get fusion working, if you don't feel comfortable using nuclear bombs to propel everything, or, you know, steam water reactors, right? Then you put up big mirrors around every planet where they can be gravitationally anchored to them, and you use those to bounce light beams from the sun all over the place that people can ride around on. That probably requires a lot of coordination, but it would probably be doable. And it would also probably be microwaves in most cases rather than, like, visible lasers.
So the next question is from Floor Horbeck. Did dimensions emerge at the same time fundamental forces separated? When it comes to gravity, it doesn't seem to be. Or were they already there at T equals zero?
The answer to that question is that we have no hard evidence of anything that happened prior to the wall of last scattering or surface of last scattering 370 to 380,000 years after we believe the Big Bang took place. So it's a little hard for us to speak to what happened that first second. We do the modeling based off of basically how clumped up are the galaxies. That's how we figure these things out or guess towards them. However, any answer I give you on that one's going to be a big question mark. Whether or not space and time had to exist before the physical constants could exist, or those came in just afterwards, is one of those ones where it might be like a, you know, how many angels can sit on the head of a pin type of thing, where we might not ever know the answer. I don't think you could have the physical constants meaningfully existing before you actually had space and time, though.
All right. The next question is from Void. And he says, the interstellar ship from Avatar had the crew and cargo behind the thrusters so that it could keep them far away from the radiation source while conserving mass. Would this actually work out?
You know, the thing on something like that is, if you wanted to keep your reactors far away, you could do the nacelle-style thing on the Enterprise. The original Starship Enterprise they have in TOS and TNG, too, they always had the engines away off on the side. And the idea there was those are supposed to be keeping radiation away from the crew. Although I think they kept the model because it looks cool, you know? To keep radiation away from your ship, you could put it forward or back, and that way have the same cross-section as you're going through interstellar space. At the same time, in a lot of cases, it's not going to be all that necessary. One reason is that you might go ahead and put your engine forward of your radiation shielding, so you have that extra layer of radiation shielding between you, the crew, and interstellar space too, because that's another your big source for it. So you can put the engine forward. I would generally tend to think it would be better to stick it behind, But then the question becomes, what is your super material that you're using for the superstructure of that ship? Is it really strong tensile, or is it really strong compressive? If it's really strong compressive strength, then you want your engine at the bottom. That way it's pushing up on the ship. If it's really strong tensile, you want to drag your ship behind the engine, you know? That's basically the key factor on that one there.
Alrighty. I just was scrolling through, and a number of folks are saying happy anniversary. Thank you all. And the next question here is from Brian Van Buren. Any chance of a return to the megastructure series with things that we can build but probably wouldn't, like Eater Worlds, Free Spheres, and World Houses, which we would likely skip in favor of O'Neill Cylinders?
Yeah, that's actually a good question. I see Sindhu just came in on the live stream pump, by the way. Okay. So yeah, that was there. One of our folks was coming just a hail late to get questions into us, so we had to interrupt the normal schedule. Speaking of megastructures, so we did the original megastructural summary. That is the original episode of the show. And I've done episodes on individual megastructurals, but one of the things we have not done is ever just do a redo on that summary so that you could actually get all of them, including the ones we can never realistically do an episode on, the ones that are short entries. So I decided to do that as my presentation to the IDSC exactly 1 month from now, which is going to be our replacement for the live stream, right? We're doing a presentation live next month's live stream in Arlington, Virginia at the International Space Development Conference at the same time, 4 o'clock. They're nice enough to be in that slot on megastructurals. And then that is following up by that is going to be a 100-minute long summary video that we'll be releasing only in June 9th, that actually will go into more detail and list every single megastructure we could come up with. And that took me and Sarah, because I was losing my voice for part of it, so she helped me out on that. It was just too much to talk, about 3 days to record. So that's our project for the next month, is to kind of process that 100-plus minute video into video format. And we're just going to release that as one big video on June 9th to kind of commemorate the talk with the IDSC and that redo, and as we come up on 8 years of the show.
Alrighty.
So yes.
It was a long recording. So I saw somebody said that they miss your episodes because they have to clean their room. They can play it in the background.
Yeah,
as
you
well.
Can. And again, we do all these on audio, even the live stream. So it misses some of the visual aspects though.
All right. So Scooter GSP says, what do you consider the most important distinction that must be considered between sci-fi and fantasy when attempting good world building in those respective settings?
Say that one more time.
The most important distinction to be considered between sci-fi and fantasy when attempting good world building.
You know, before we were going on AI, I was noticing the comments, I think it was Nihil, one of the others was asking if I'd ever read Michael Moorcock. He's a fantasy writer, and he does some kind of sci-fi flavors. And ironically, that's the audiobook I'm listening to recently, because they just released a new updated version of the audio for him. He has some very old recordings that were kind of lower quality. And the forward is actually by Neil Gaiman. It's very good to listen to. So, he's one of those fancy authors that I think of as from the same period as like Roger Zelazny, where a lot of time, or Anne McCaffrey, where they blur the line between fantasy and science fiction a lot. And in the more modern context, you get so many of the ones that are like Gamma World, where it's the post-apocalyptic Earth is what the fantasy is. That's you see that with Terry Bookshinawa series, for instance. Or the Middle Earth of Tolkien, that's actually Earth some ages back, right, is the idea there. And I'd say with all these things, we are trying to get that line between science fiction and fantasy, and you're trying to get that little bit of realism. The key thing is to follow Sanderson's Law, it's another fantasy writer, and the first one of that is basically, whatever you're introducing is magic, whatever you're introducing in your system, as much fun can be had from that by knowing what its limitations are, and keep it consistent so the audience can think about it, as can by just having a deus ex machina, which admittedly Tolkien tended to do a lot, was magic could do whatever it could do at the time. You never really knew how strong it was. And there was a flavor to that can be good for writing too, but if you're looking for these long series and interactions with your audiences and things like that, whether it's a science fiction technology or a fantasy technology, or fantasy magic, is just having this kind of realism of interaction where the audience can think about what they would be able to do with it. Maybe even the equivalent of running a D&D campaign set in that. And that's also where you get people writing back in this modern time we interact with our audiences saying, hey, you could do X, Y, or Z with it instead too. And that's important, although you need to keep that kind of thing once it gets canonized, because It can cause problems. Your audience is looking at something, you suddenly break the rules that's been going on for a series of books or films. You as an example, everybody loved the cinematic effect in Last Jedi where they rammed that one ship at hyperspeed. Beautiful cinematography, but that was such a game breaker to all the previous films and shows that it upset people at the same time too. So
we seem to have quite a bit of interest in nuclear technology today, so I'm going to try to lump some of these together. Sean McMaster wants to know if it's possible to build a clean nuclear bomb that could be used for terraforming and propulsion with little to no radiation contamination. Opposite of a dirty bomb, what isotopes would it use?
The key to building a clean bomb is to build bigger ones for the most part, because what's happening with it is they usually tend to get a better burn on bigger bombs, and a lot of it has to do with the geometry of the bomb too. Your default dirty bomb is essentially one that's inefficient, and all the auto styles tended to be just because they were lower yield, and they tend to be the gun style, which is where you're just slamming two things together. Your preferred method of doing them is to do the to basically implode the device, just like with a supernova. You're putting explosives all around a sphere of the stuff to detonate it in one tiny sphere. That's kind of your critical one. I would say the biggest one to actually have cleaner bombs is to start testing back up again. And I know people don't really like the idea of doing nuclear testing on the planet, which is why a lot of us favor doing it on the moon. So the moon has already a radiation-scarred heck hole, so you can go ahead and blow it to bits. But that would be my best statement for how to go about doing that is, if you're trying to go for lower yield ones, you're probably going to have to use fission as your main factor there, in which case you are going to have some relatively large amounts of fallout. Fusion bombs are the ones that let you really kick up the amount because they don't have those isotopes being used as much. You use them to set the explosion up, but there's a lower yield percentage-wise of that unused burn isotopes. But I would say in that case, testing is the best way to find a better setup for what's going to minimize it. I don't think you're going to find a different isotope to use that would be plentiful, though. You're going to have to stick to that uranium-thorium cycle.
All right. Thank you, TKG Wildfire, for your super chat. And he wants to know, what would be a possible energy-to-mass ratio for ion engines to get from surface to space and atmosphere with current or near-future technology?
Energy to mass ratio or power to mass ratio?
Well, he said energy to mass ratio, but if we should be talking power to mass ratio.
Well, either one can work in that context. You need to be able to kick out an awful lot of energy out of an ion drive, and they're kind of not designed with that in mind. The critical aspect of the ion drive is that you're trying to shoot an ion out the back at much higher velocity than gas comes out the back of a normal rocket engine. And the problem is that the gas is coming out of that engine based on how hot it is. In a typical rocket plume, your speed of your gas is based on what gas it is, hydrogen being the one that tends to come out the fastest because it's very light at a given temperature, and that's the key thing there, how hot it gets. Well, the ion engine is basically using it like an old vacuum tube to shoot the things out the back. If you try to really increase the density on something like that in terms of how much it's thrusting out to get that higher power ratio, you're going to start getting heat. And that's going to be problematic because you basically have the same issue we have with rockets, which is, we will melt the rocket if we get any hotter than that. So I think that's your limitation on ion engines. I don't really expect them to ever be a good atmospheric exit device. I mean, that would basically be the answer on that one, I'm afraid.
William Walter. Hi, Isaac. When talking about the star the Earth revolves around, could you say soul? Thanks for entertaining this question and entertaining and informing me for years.
I usually call it Sol, I think, but the problem is that with a lot of it's because it is solar system as opposed to Sol. But I think the problem is that for a lot of our audience, and this is a critical thing I always have to remember, most people coming in, even if they're scientifically minded to watch our show, do not know what we are talking about for large chunks of the episode. And most people don't know the term Sol as the name for our sun. By default coming in, it's just that's a newer thing to call it that. They'll recognize Luna, but they might not recognize Sol, And so I will try to pronounce it as Sol, though, now I think about it, because I've always been calling it Sol. But yes, with that in mind.
Thank you, Merv Johnson, for your super chat. What are secondary tech implied from a working Alcubierre drive?
Alcubierre drive?
Expanding and contracting space and time. Artificial gravity or anti-gravity? Easier fusion? What else? Happy anniversary.
Gravity and anti-gravity would be the big one, because with those you should be able to actually compress space-time in front of you or expand it behind you. Specifically, to compress in front of you would be the more important part, I think, in some ways. If you can kind of constantly fall forward, that helps a lot. Even if it's like the kind of the concept we see with like the, I believe it's the differential drive. One of those hypothetical ones that relies on things like negative mass actually existing. For the warp drive to really exist as a faster than light method, I think you have to have negative matter or genuine negative energy. And I think people often mistake when we say negative energy, we discover negative energy or something like that. They mean lower than the vacuum level or the base vacuum level, like it's that false vacuum or vacuum energy level. They don't really mean a negative quantity as opposed to like we cancel out normal energy. You know, it doesn't quite work that way. And if we find those, things change a lot. Suddenly you can go ahead and say, yep, warp drives or warps, they should work.
Albert Jackinson says, happy anniversary, Isaac and Sarah. I have no questions today, surprise, but I'm here watching as always. Here's to, hopefully, many more anniversaries.
Thank you very much. And again, as I mentioned in the start, Sarah suggested while we were engaged that she should come on and ask me questions that would make the format a little bit better than me kind of reading them off and answering them. And I agreed that we didn't actually get a chance to implement it until after we came back from our honeymoon. So that was that very first one. I think, I can't remember if it was the first one that I still did normally in May or if we actually switched over that very first May or not, but it has worked out a lot.
It was a long process to convince you that you would look at the camera more if I was talking.
That's probably true, too, though. It was mostly because it was hard to go back and forth to reading the questions, and it sounds better with somebody else asking them anyway. But there are a lot of folks involved in the live stream, and it does make it a lot easier. Like, there's a lot of podcast hosts who do this daily, the live stream thing, and obviously practice helps with everything. But, yeah, I don't know how they would do that without a relatively large crew. And, of course, most of the ones that look good do actually have a crew involved. So,
absolutely. Well, Alexei Kirian, thank you for your super chat. He wants to know, you talk a lot about lasers being used to push spacecraft to high speeds, but is it viable to use light generated by the craft itself for this?
No, not really. The idea is, well, if you do it at that point in time, it becomes what's called a photon rocket, right? A photon rocket, and I'll give you two examples of how you would do a photon rocket in a second. The problem with a photon rocket is that you're only getting the actual regular rocket equation set up of you're emitting something. It's a great fuel if you've got a condensed like that. I mean, it's the best one out there, but it's still not going to be as good as a laser sail in terms of both the reflection mirror aspect, which is going to double your gain out of that, and the fact that you're still following the rocket equation, which means you're carrying your fuel with you. Admittedly, if that is your fuel, it makes a lot less difference, but I think you'd almost always use that launch assist of having the stuff. So how would we actually do a photon rocket realistically? Antimatter is basically a photon rocket. Technically, you get other byproducts besides photons from antimatter, though. But same difference. The other one would be, and I would say a neutrino drive would also work as this too. Although it's not a photon rocket at that point, it'd be a neutrino drive, but they go very nearly the speed of light. Possibly a dark matter drive, depending if it's WIMPs or not. But the idea being like, let's say I'm in a perfect box that was mirror aligned. It was reflective to frequencies of light, and it was a perfect mirror, right? I mean, it could bounce light back and forth trillions and trillions and trillions of times and not lose a single photon and during that normal, you know, duration. Well, now you can fill that thing up with light and slowly release that from the old light cage, and that is a fuel source, like antimatter, only better in some ways. And then, of course, Hawking radiation off a black hole could do something like that, too. But like anything with the rocket equation, you have to carry your fuel, which means as you get close to what that, you know, that rocket exhaust velocity is, or that fuel, you start having to carry a lot more fuel relative to, you know, to the mass of your ship. And we don't want that. And then, of course, with the laser, the big thing is the photon is coming in and then it is going right backward. So it gives twice the momentum the ship if it bounces off it. Whereas if it's just getting emitted out the back, one momentum. So that's the advantage of that there. The downsides of obviously is your fuel is not on board, which is you got to maintain that lock. You depend on that lock, and of course that lock is hard to maintain. That's the hard one. Plus, you need that lock. You need that device at the other end of your destination to stop you. So,
Alexei sent us a smiley face and said, "By the way, happy anniversary." So I think he's very glad we got to his question. Eric Johansson, thank you for your super chat. Why do intelligent hive minds in sci-fi always have to use ridiculous telepathy? Can't they just talk to each other?
Low bandwidth, actually. That's a very good point to raise. If you think about, you know, we do actually pack a lot more data into our spoken voice and our body language than raw text. We tend to forget that raw text, you know, doesn't contain that much information. But if you go by, say, my voice, and I know my voice when I'm narrating the show is 180 words per minute. I can figure out the length of an episode in advance off of that. That's just tend to be where I'm at. So 180 words per minute. Well, let's say we use the old bit data of that and assume that was all of, what, 180 bytes per minute of data that was compressing through there. You know, maybe a whole kilobyte per minute. That's really slow. A kilobyte per second is really slow. I remember when kilobyte per second was actually a fast internet rate, but nonetheless, that's a really slow rate. If your hive mind has to do it by spoken like that, not going to get a lot of data in there. That could work better with some creatures that, like, I think one of our examples we used in the alien languages was they had a, you know, 4x4 semi-4 grid of eyeballs they blinked really, really fast or emitted lights from. That might allow you something that moved at that kind of speed, but not a very good hive mind if it's only on a spoken level. And of course, you might say, well, if it's at the spoken level, what's an example of a hive mind? Us, we would be an example of a hive mind. And as I like to point out, we are a very limited form of networked intelligence or hive mind. And, you know, going back to our earlier tribal days, and we expanded to be able to increase that to calm people up or send people messages or runners. And at one point, with writing, we learned how to actually network dead people into our hive mind. Because a written language allows you to incorporate the undead into people who wrote things, you know, centuries ago into your networked intelligence. So, interesting concept for that.
Potato says, hello, love the channel. I think I have watched every episode. If time travel was possible, could we theoretically enter a black hole and then time travel back in time with all the new knowledge learned?
There's a lot of ifs in that one. you know, obviously, if you've watched all the episodes, you tend to know my view on time travel. I think we've done two independent episodes on it alone. I don't tend to be a big fan of it, but I view the idea that black holes really let you time travel or travel in wormholes to different locations, I really do view that as kind of an artifact of the math. It's there, right? It is one of the solutions in Einstein's general relativity equation, or Noether's. It says, yes, that you could hypothetically do these things. I tend to feel that is limiting yourself to an assumption of a math is right, as opposed to the physical laws of this universe are right, and the math applies where it does. So I don't expect that to be the case. But yeah, in theory, if you could get into a black hole, there are options for time travel there. I think they'd have to be closed time-like ones, though, because otherwise you get all those paradox issues, which, you know, it's easy for people to get. When you move backward in time, you're moving information and energy backward in time, too. So let's say I got stuff falling backward in time. Well, now the universe has more energy to wherever I time traveled to than it did before. That changes everything right there, because now you got more energy density and gravity at that spot that thing is emerged at. That wasn't there previously. It affects all the universe around, etc. For those of you who've seen the black hole bomb concept from Kurzgesagt, you could potentially set up a doomsday weapon around this the same way you could with a wormhole by just dropping something into it over and over again backward in time. So you just have to start opening up options like that, and that gets worrisome. Though you can't do that trick with wormholes where you drop it into a gate that sends it back up and keeps dropping it. That will actually lose energy as it goes back up the top of the wormhole gate. See our episode on wormholes for more discussion of that, so I don't go down a rabbit trail.
Jamie Russell, thank you for your super chat.
I use my wife's face as an expression when I know I'm going down rabbit trails. Go ahead.
Why wouldn't we presume the Earth is near the center of the universe if we notice galaxies, nearly all, going away from the Earth in all directions?
That is the most obvious conclusion you can make off of that. And this is a problem, right? The Copernican principle says that we are mediocre principle, that we're just part of the universe, which have been infinite in size under the time they were discussing this. They thought there was infinite number of stars, otherwise it would collapse together. Based on all available evidence, the Earth is the center of the universe. Now, you say, what? Okay, because the universe goes out in a certain direction from where we can see. Based on all evidence, the universe is centered on Earth. That is what all the evidence says. All the common sense applied to that says, It's like I'm standing in the middle of a warehouse and I have a light that lets me see for about 10 feet around me. I should not assume that I am the center of the warehouse just because I can see the same distance in every direction. So we assume the universe is much bigger than the area we can see. There's a lot of reasons to think that this is true besides, you know, the common sense extrapolation, but yes, the Earth is the center of the known observable universe.
All right. Next question is from Kimmel Abu. Love your channel, Isaac. Let me grab a drink and a snack. And speaking of which, what do you see as the current future of farming? Factory farming is the current cutting edge, but what's on the horizon for us?
I was going to say, I got a tractor sitting outside the window. Its future is sitting there until the fields dry up or do anything with it. For those who didn't know, Sarah and I have a farm here. That this is where we're actually at. There's a farm outside of here. And she grew up farming. I just grew up in the country, so I'm gardening. But I have views on the idea that we would do less open-air farming, but there is one problem with that. You can produce way more product inside a climate-controlled situation, even just like a greenhouse. Cheap greenhouse, possibly with a plastic or polycarbonate made out of, you know, biofuels, such as various bioplastics. You can do that. And that will give you higher production. And that might potentially actually give you a net profit down the road a ways. We're not really there yet. It depends on how much automation is involved in the system. However, while I do not believe the Earth's population is going to decline anytime soon or at all, and I think it's going to continue to grow, I do think that growth rate is slowing off. And right now there's more than enough arable land when managed properly with just known techniques used in developed countries to feed, I'd say, probably 20 billion people without having to hack too much into the rest of the setup. Obviously, that depends a lot on what areas you're considering protected. Are you going to treat a pasture land as protected? Are you going to have pasture land for animals? Or, you know, are you going just to strictly a vegetarian or, you know, feedlot style thing as opposed to pasturing your cow? Are you giving them grain you grew? Those all change the number around on how much you can sport. So does if you switch to more of a fish and algae-based food or if you do more GMOs. But there is no problem right now requiring us to be more efficient in terms of requiring like greenhousing over all of our farms to produce enough food for everybody. And I really would not expect that in the coming decades. But if we do get severe climatic shifts, for instance, you might see a lot of that existing on open farms that are now in place. Because at that point in time, you got the farm already there established. You might decide you want to close it over so you keep in better moisture or keep out, you know, improve your drainage. There's a lot of options on that, but I think the big one, the takeaway is the future of robot farming for the near future is not that it's hydroponics or it's not that it's shifting to a closed greenhouse environment. It's that it's shifting to automation, mm-hmm. automation. In large part, the biggest one, because I don't think people are really embracing the genetic engineering aspect of crops as much. So automation, they seem to be much more comfortable with.
Being able to improve things as you go along, the speed, the efficiency, and the back-breaking aspects.
It really is nice to have an enclosed cab on your tractor with air conditioning and a Bluetooth radio.
Especially when you have bees.
Yes, yeah. Get those started again soon.
Okay, so thanks if you read it. Says, if most super tech sci-fi, we see basic shapes, spheres, hexagons, etc., could this be because we send scientists and engineers to space and not artists and designers?
There is a desire for beauty in these environments. And one of the things I mentioned in our upcoming Megastructures movie, it's called a movie, it's the Megastructure Compendium, but it's movie-like, is that you would expect a lot of these, what are we calling them, because we can, BCW Megastructures, the ones like the Flat Earth or the Sombrero Planet, that those exist in a future, not because they're common, but because when you're building millions and millions of O'Neill cylinders, you got the funds to build one or two of these other type too. Indeed, you might want to be doing them just as a way to store heavy mass like your stored up fusion fuel. However, when you go down the street, you look at the houses nearby you, and what do you see? You see A-frames, right? A-frames because that's what you must work with for housing for timber. When you look at skyscrapers, what do you mostly see? Big rectangles. Why? Because that's what works best with steel. We had a lot more arches in Rome because they could use, you know, that was their height of their way of supporting heavy structures. We can do much buildable buildings now, which is why you don't see quite as much arch and dome stuff in our stadiums, for instance, or larger lecture halls and auditoriums. We don't have to use an arch setup to hold the building up. So yes, it's beautiful to have all these wonderful autistic buildings with their non-rectilinear designs and things like that. I can't remember the one architect that does, I think it starts with a G, but he does a lot of non-rectilinear shapes. And those, I think, will always be the minority, though. And that might change if we get to the point that we got super strong materials as cheap as dirt, which might happen with something like graphene or diamondoids. And it might change if we have a lot more automation construction. But right now, for the next few generations at least, I would tend to assume that we would always see that same A-frame setup. Same then for space habitats and megastructures. They might do all sorts of really cool, bizarre-shaped things, but I think you'd still see that standard of, let's do a lot of cylinders, let's do a lot of rings, let's do a lot of hexagons,
Leighton Brown. Isaac, I love your content. In an infinite universe where everything that can happen will happen, what type of planet or system would you most like to explore?
Me, personally? This is ironic because the episode I just got done recording is Life as a Planetary Explorer, which is kind of came out of an episode we were doing that turned into a trilogy instead. That will come out sometime in July, I believe. What would life be life as a planetary explorer? And you say, well, what would be a cool place to explore? And the thing is, everything that comes to mind is examples from some book I've read. And so I think, where would I be exploring at? Well, here on Earth in some virtual reality where those have come to life. I think for me, the one I'd most like to explore, though, personally, would be like a really ancient Ecumenopolis, one of those places where they just done the layer after layer after layer for billions of years. And now it was an empty out tomb ward, and you just got to explore all of that because it would be endless archaeological digs. That to me is the one that would be most awesome to explore. Ecumenopolis gone tomb ward.
All right, last question before the break here. I will do a fun one. Niall wants to know, what kind of music do you listen to?
Okay, that's a good question before we go to break. It depends on the genre. Classics-wise, Ravel's Bolero is my personal favorite. Let's see. I would say probably the one that I tend to think of as Sting is my favorite musician overall. I've loved his work since the late 90s, and he's been producing longer. Sting from The Police. Then after that, so Phantom Metallica, Nirvana less so than Foo Fighters. I actually like the Foo Fighters incarnation of that band more. Alice in Chains, Garbage. There's a lot of them. I'm a kid of the 90s and the 80s. I grew up on MTV, so a lot of those. Right. Let's go ahead and head to break, and we'll see you in about 4 minutes.
So we'll be on break for a few minutes, and it's a great time to get some more questions in for part two and for our lightning round at the end, as well as get a drink and a snack. This will also be the last chance to get in live questions till summertime, as next month our live stream will be coming live from the International Space Development Conference, where I'll be giving a talk on megastructures and their rebroadcast to their crowd and on this channel at our usual time. They were nice enough to give me the 4 p.m. slot on Sunday, May 29th. Prepping for that finally got me off the fence to redo our original Episode 0, the Megastructural Summary, from way back in 2014, and a couple weeks after the conference we'll be airing the Megastructural Compendium, which I just got done drafting as I write this mid-break, amusingly on April 1st. It clocks in at the moment at 17,000 words. Our usual main script minus sponsor and announcements is generally about a quarter of that to a third of that for long episodes, and it's probably going to have a runtime of 100 minutes, making it our longest episode ever. But I've decided not to cut it down or break it into multiple episodes. I knew it was going to be a long one. I suspect that's the major reason I've put off remaking it so long, as I not only wanted to redo the original, but get in all the new megastructures we discussed since then, and actually a lot we've never gotten to discuss at all. It was around 100 entries, all alphabetical, in the end. Or at least as of the time I'm writing this. I suspect for the sake of preserving my vocal cords, I'll ask Sarah and maybe a couple others to help narrate it. Before we get back to the show, since I'm probably still making another cup of coffee on the break in real time, we had a good question from Calvin Green after last month's show. He asked if nuclear bombs are bright enough to be used as interstellar signaling devices, and the short answer is yes, easily, and the longer answer is no. One of the problems with seeing nuclear blasts on a planet as a technocentral, for instance, ignoring that it might indicate technology is on its way out on that world,
is that they are both overshadowed by the overall brightness of that planet and something of a white light source. Our ideal interstellar signal is a directed beam on a single tight band of frequency or wavelength, and not be in a place or range where it's just impossible to really distinguish it from noise. Now, if someone does have a telescope trained on a planet that can give any sort of detail, then yes, they'll see an anomaly of brightness. A megaton nuclear bomb gives off about 1/50th of the energy hitting Earth in any given second, and sunlight itself doesn't really vary that rapidly in intensity. Plus, you probably have a scope on the sun too, and we'll know it didn't cause that blip. Most of that light is going out in a few seconds, so a replay is going to give off some very clear telltales of a nuclear blast, especially if it was on the night side, including lots of emission and absorption lines. Alternatively, as an actual signaling device, like a flare gun in space, it's not bad. A nuclear blast designed to serve as a signal flare, though, would be even better. You could potentially rig one up as a bomb pulse laser on a given frequency and direction, in which case that might actually be detectable outside the galaxy, but you could also build the case around one to essentially absorb and re-emit much of the energy in a specific distinct band, like a fluorescent light or mercury lamp, and that might come to be the SOS of interstellar space, especially as the blast would have some red or blue shift with the ship's speed that could be used to help determine where escape pods, or more likely escape freezer tubes, might have drifted to by the time you arrive. There's a number of other possible ways to use a nuke, or nukes, as a signal too. Maybe a topic for a future episode. So, great question, Calvin. I hope I answered it. As usual, we don't have time for every question, even with a lightning round, and most folks miss the live session and see the replay. So I try to get to the questions folks leave afterwards in the comments section, and pick ones to answer on the breaks the next month. Though of course not next month this time, as I'll be giving that talk I mentioned a couple minutes ago. Alright, let's get back to more of your questions.
Hi, welcome back everybody. I had a timing thing right there for it, and I still missed it.
I was having fun watching the little robot character get his drink and snack and didn't realize that.
He's going to become my automatic default to remind me to come on back to it, though this time it was using the mushroom cloud, but it was on the delayed signal. So for anyone who doesn't know, that usually these things don't go completely live. There's like a 20-second lag time between whatever I say and whatever shows up. So that's over on another screen. So there's like four or five screens up here. And I think she was still using a tablet and a phone, too, at the same
time. Yeah. Distractions. All right. Well, let's jump right back in. And Clash says, with the Enceladus and Uranus missions heavily considered by NASA, how far off do you think fast, cheap exploration of the solar system is?
I think, honestly, I would say it's going to be inside this, not this next decade. Everyone's putting a little bit too much stuff in this decade. It is amazing what we've gotten done, in terms of just this new commercialization approach to space that we always hoped for in the 90s and 1000s and didn't see get developed, and now it's here, you know? And I don't think we can see a sudden upswell in robot probes going out this decade, but think of 2030s as the time we launch all the, the late 2020s maybe, but the 2030s, that's when we launch all the probes. Of course, they're going to take a long time to get there, so it might be the 2040s in some case if we get to hear back from them.
Jerry's stories, if you had perfect mirrors and could perfectly collimate light, you could build active support structures that use photons instead of particles.
So we could. That'd be Jerry Gorn. By the way, if you haven't been to Jerry's stories, one of our regular editors, Jerry Gorn, that's where he keeps a lot of his short stories he writes that he's recorded in audio format at my suggestion. And he's a great narrator. So go make sure you check out Jerry's stories. Yes, you could use that for active support too. You know, it's that pressure you could get from it. Same for if you had a perfect room temperature superconductor and magnetic shielding.
Isaac Bordeaux, happy anniversary. And what do you think the Earth will look like in the year 3000?
I think that the Earth will look like,
Earth?
I think that by the year 3000, you'd probably expect there to be so many orbital structures around us in orbit. You know, the Terra and Swarm we sometimes talk about, which also appears in the upcoming Megastructures video June 9th, that you would probably have a rule about people not being able to put, so many lights in the visible range on. All the guidance lights would probably be intentionally put into other frequencies that were not visible. And you would probably have people expected to paint their space structures black. Just they weren't reflecting the night with 5 billion stars. What do I expect Earth to look like by then? is going to be the most valuable piece of real estate in the universe for the next million years at least, right? At least our part of the universe, you know, until we get into some other species, like, well, we've been around for a billion years already. In which case, I would expect it to continue to rise in value and development. I don't think it's going to turn into some glass and concrete monstrosity, though. So
I think you may have answered Joseph's question along the way, but he wants to know if we will make it for another 100 years or if the AI will take us out.
I don't know. I think not. I really don't. I don't think that AI will take us out. I could see AI and cyborgs and transhumans supplanting us, but I don't think that they would take us out. I think we'd still be around, you know?
All right. Ram Dan says, hello, Isaac. I am a big fan, and I want to ask you, could it be, in theory, possible to use exotic mass to make a TARDIS-like spaceship that's bigger on the inside?
Yes. That is another fun thing you can do with anti-gravity or gravity control, if it's good enough, too, is you can start creating spaces that are bigger on the inside than the outside. You can start getting your closet that is the size of the TARDIS closet, as you will. And I think that I would be very dubious if we'd ever get anything that level of fine control, but anti-gravity is one of those areas, or artificial gravity production is one of those areas where I don't rule it out the same way I do like perpetual motion machines or fast light travel, because there is nothing explicitly forbidding us from manipulating gravitons, right? Whereas those others seem to actually violate laws. I don't know that I would think that would ever get us to actually do the big on the inside and outside thing. But yes, you can warp space and time with control of gravity. So hypothetically, you could have the idea of hammer space, you know, the old pulling the anvil out of nowhere hammer space idea, which has so many applications. It's ridiculous, but is great for luggage. You could carry so much luggage around with that. And since anti-gravity or gravity controlled, you could make it lighter too. So it's not just that it's big on the inside. You could pack a whole house in there and drag it behind you. Or keep it in your
pocket. So you mean I wouldn't just be theoretically packing the whole house at that point?
Correct, yes. Well, we're guilty of that, I suppose. We don't pack as light as we should.
Ramuk says, if we know that Dyson spheres or swarms are demonstrably more efficient, then why don't sci-fi shows or books ever use them?
Well, it depends on the sci-fi writer in question. They show up in books a lot. You know, they're not as... But it's hard to write something at that scale, right? You, as a writer, are trying to produce a story about humans. Possibly aliens, but humans anyway, right? About people and having this kind of background. Going to even something like the Ringworld, right? Think of the Ringworld novel with Larry Niven. It's on this gigantic structure that's over a million times the living area of Earth. And yet, the story, while it tries to cover so much of that, is really more like that is the big dumb object they're exploring, the reason why these people are going, that actually is the tale of that place. A Dyson Swarm is, to me, it's the background in which you set a story, because it lets you do all these things without FTL. You have all these artificial worlds so near each other that you can travel under known laws of science between them in days and hours and weeks. You know, you can do that. So to me, it's the replacement for fashion light travel. That's its main story focus. A Dyson Swarm lets you have millions of worlds within short travel times. Well, if you already have FTL as something audiences are comfortable with, and even those of us who don't believe it ever is going to exist are comfortable with it as a sci-fi tool, then you don't really need to put that into play. But I'd say that's the big one. And then, of course, the other one is Dyson Swarms are mostly composed of rotating habitats and things like that. And while we're starting to see those pop up a lot more in fiction now, in terms of visuals for them, they still haven't really become that normal mainstay, and they still take a lot of special effects, and they're hard to film inside of, so to speak. You're not getting that quote of horizon while you're filming the desert somewhere here on Earth.
Vincent Cleaver, thank you for your super chat. He says, happy anniversary. Thank you.
Thank you.
The next question is from Isaac Bordeaux. Excited to see the updated Megastructures video. Do you think that you will ever remake your Kardashev scale video?
Technically, there's two episodes of that, because that was when we messed up the music and put it in too loud, and I didn't want to take the video down by the time people noticed it, so I released the second one that had no music in the background for that. I think we probably would. I have rules. I don't repeat episodes, right? But I'm willing to remake some of the classic ones with new updated material and stuff like that. So we probably will see an update of the Forming Paradox Compendium / Solutions video if the Megastructures Compendium goes well. Because again, it's a 90-100 minute video. I don't really want to start doing tons of those. It's just, you know,
he's saying episode. Get ready to have a very long. Long science fiction with Isaac Arthur, or science and futurism with Isaac Arthur, watching Sfree, so that you can give a thumbs up to that 100-minute video.
So if everybody watches that video and does very well, obviously there would be more of the video. So there you go. But it's obviously going to take, it's going to basically be a month-long project to make.
Like and share with your friends.
Yes.
Thank you. All right. Eric Johansson, thank you for your super chat. Are deadly cocktails of specialized viruses, bacteria, and parasites a good option for future pesticides instead of toxic chemicals that we use today?
I mean, in terms of being effective, a virus bombing a planet is always a good approach. I think somebody asked us, like, how would you go ahead and, you know, engage in alien invasion? What would you expect? And say, well, they want to wipe us out. They'd probably pepper us with their garbage as the fleet was coming to orbit, then virus bomb us, then nuke us, then send in the hunter killers to find us individually and get the survivors. I think that we wouldn't be very reluctant to use artificially tailored viruses for pest control. I don't think very many people are going to be comfortable with the idea of us releasing artificially tailored viruses. In the long term, as people get more comfortable with that, maybe, right? But I think, especially, like, if you'd asked me a couple of years ago, well, not a couple of years ago, if you asked me 3 years ago, I'd have said we probably could get more comfortable with that technology. I would say that we have at least a couple of generations right now that would hear the term artificially tailored virus to be used around for, you know, pest control and say no, right?
And it may depend on the context, though, because, like, some infected nematodes are being used currently in farming practices to eliminate other types of pests. Mm-hmm. So it probably depends on the context and the scale.
Sure, yeah, and I'd agree with that, too. But, you know, again, pest control with existing bits of biology or mildly tailored ones is a lot more okay to folks than, I think right now, the term genetically engineered viruses is going to be too much for folks for a while.
TKG Wildfire, thank you for your super chat. What would be the best crops to grow on new colonies?
I mean, your core ones, they're going to give you that balance of nutrients that you actually have to get. Proteins, anything in the case like that, proteins. Whatever can actually grow on the local regolith would be ideal too. We talk about hydroponics a lot as an option, but it is nice to actually have that soil aspect. So anything that can, as a secondary aspect, to actually get you some soil production going on. The biggest one I would say probably be something you could use for plastics. I think that would probably be your single biggest crop would be your base medium for making plastics out of, like polycarbonates, etc. Poppy algae.
I just saw a comment that said that they love your string tie. Very old west.
Thank you. My farming tie.
I thought you said it was your pie tie.
It is my pie tie.
Isaac, if pulsars are used as interstellar GPS systems, how would a navigation coordinate system be built around them?
Badly. Pulsar was all an amazing lucky find in terms of their accuracy, but you got to keep in mind, we talk about, well, you got the pulsars all over the galaxy. That's a good way to find your location if you fell through like a warp portal into some weird part of the galaxy or universe, and where you were, you could start checking pulsars, assuming that warp portal just conveniently dumps you out at the same point in time too, which is not really how that kind of stuff would work. Otherwise, though, you'd be a lot better off taking some local red dwarf or star, putting some statites around it as your power supply, and then picking a frequency of sound, and then doing exactly what we do with our GPS right now. This is my identifier code, and the time is. This is my identifier code, and the time is. And from that, you listen to five or six of those and say, aha. And your time is down to millionths or billionths of a second, right? Which lets you get pretty accurate, which is kind of nice when you're dealing with speeds that might be in excess of kilometers per second and want to know where you're actually at. Pulsars, your accuracy might be milliseconds, which is not bad, especially if you're trying to figure out where in the approximate region of space you are, but it's not going to let you really be working accurately inside a solar system.
Joseph says, given that humanity has survived to this extent, what is the possibility that there is an external alien force protecting us?
I would guess, but this is one of those ones where you cannot actually tell from the evidence around you if such a thing is or isn't true. So you speculate. It comes out like simulation hypothesis. Are we in a reality or are we not? The idea that there was a benevolent outside alien force or entity, take your pick, right, is basically to follow the idea of is this the setup that we'd expect to see based on their motivation to help us, right? They say, well, if their idea is they don't want us to suffer any sort of pain or harm, then obviously they wouldn't exist because this isn't a harmless or painless existence. But at the same time, if their goal was to, you know, and again, you start going through that list and then your guesstimate's as good as mine for that, but you cannot answer a question like that from external evidence around you. You are basically trying to say, based on this external evidence and the assumption of what their motivation is, does it fit? And that's kind of your limitation on that. We'll talk about that more in the Godlike Aliens episode that is actually up on the screen above my head right now.
Coming out May 5th. All right, Sam Evra. Hello, Isaac. First off, happy anniversary.
Thank you.
In many sci-fi stories, precursor races are often major parts to a story, but seem to, at least to me, very unrealistic. How would you rate precursors?
One of my favorite pages on TV tropes, which is like a black hole of a website that you'll get lost in for hours. It's worse than Wikipedia that way. You start opening up new links on new links and new links till you've got 40 links open on your web browser and all of them to different articles. But TV tropes, I think I actually have an entry there too. They have a precursor page on benevolent precursors, neglectful precursors, and abusive precursors. And they go through a lot of sci-fi races and try to hold them accountable. And I would love to actually do, you know, some side episodes one day on just like which these classic science fiction precursor races qualify as which and for which reason. Abusive precursor races are they hate us, they kind of, or they just don't like us all. Think your H.P. Lovecraft precursors like Cthulhu. The benevolent ones, we see those a lot of times in sci-fi. But then as we examine them more, they don't really seem that way anymore because it's a question of why don't they help out the heroes? Why aren't they doing anything? And the reasons given tend to make them seem more like neglectful or even malevolent, abusive precursors. And of course, the real reason is if they help the heroes out in the show all the time or in the book, the series would be very boring because somebody's stepping in to help them out constantly. But it often makes them come off as very unbelievable and implausible. And again, see that Godlike Aliens episode for more details on that May 5th.
All right, we have a super chat here from Christian Corello. Thank you. Can a Dyson Swarm be mobile, like a giant ship, and encompass multiple stars?
Yes.
Oh, that wasn't all of the question.
Okay, go ahead.
Okay. Also, is there any way to run by you ideas for a sci-fi novel I plan on writing, including illustrations I made?
That's a tricky one. First to answer the question, yes. You can absolutely make a Maltese Dyson style system. One of those is also going to be on Megastructural's Compendium episode coming out June 9th. But you can certainly do conglomerations of stars in these things. And you can move them. See our Fleet of Stars episode for more discussion of that. But especially the Quasar Drive is the best way to move them. The second question, when it comes to people writing books and saying to me these days, the answer in most cases is no. I'm always happy looking at illustrations. I love seeing them. But it's just not realistic timeline-wise anymore. There's a number of people I often do it for, and I'm still back pending on backlogs from like 4 or 5 years ago. So there was exceptions. Like I hope Dennis E. Taylor review one of his novels. That was great, you know. But for the most part, no, not so much. Sorry. What I do suggest in cases like this, though, is our social media forums, because there are a lot of other writers in there. And in fact, that first episode, the Megastructural Compendium, was actually written not as an episode for YouTube, but as kind of a help log for other people in a sci-fi forum of writers that I was regularly helping out at, where they'd ask, is this realistic or not? So if I could, I would probably put those as one of my highest priorities, but the problem is it's just too many of them.
Mark Terpstra, I heard that the solar wind, every known element in it. I'm sorry, that one didn't make sense to me. If this is true, how hard would it be to capture these elements? Does that make sense as a question?
Yeah, our star lifting episode would discuss that a little bit more, but the basic idea is solar wind is mostly hydrogen, and then it's mostly helium, and not just because that's the majority of what our sun is. 1% of our sun is stuff that is not hydrogen or helium. And of course, most of that is actually oxygen, silicon, iron, etc. Actually, not that much silicon, really, but a lot of oxygen and so forth. But that tends not to blow away. Same as the gas that most leaks off of Earth is hydrogen, followed by helium because it doesn't bond to anything. The heavier gas is, the more likely it is to not, you know, to stay put. So a lot of those heavier materials stay inside. you can blow them off. And that's the kind of the key of star lifting is that you try to push chunks of it out there to grab them. But the solar wind itself is almost entirely hydrogen. And but there's a lot of elements there that you're not really going to find just because they're not that common. But yeah, you're going to have that one part per trillion of that material. But, you know, it's hard to harvest. See the stall lifting episode for details.
Okay. We have a question here.
That episode one of these days. Go ahead.
What?
Should we do the stall lifting episode someday?
Well, you said you don't do redos.
Yeah, but I could expand on it a lot.
All right. Ishiki Brown, do you think that in the future, when humans colonize planets, there will be planet-sized population migrations like we might see in the near future due to climate change?
I don't think you'd have the population of an entire planet move from one planet to another. I think, and this is the key thing, is like, we have sci-fi that, and this is dreadful sci-fi in my opinion, they basically say that we are ruining this planet, so we need to terraform this other planet and move there. Nothing we're doing to our planet right now would actually be harder to fix than to set up in the first place on another planet. If we nuked this place till it turned to glass and blew the air off and the oceans in their entirety, it would still be easier to terraform this planet than Mars. So, you know, and this kind of goes in the idea here of if you have a dirty campsite, you can pick up and move to another location, or you can clean up your campsite. The reason why you move your campsite, if you're a decent person, is because you would like to go see another location, not because you're a pig.
So, okay.
Fix your home world.
All right.
And I suspect your neighbors will feel the same way. It's like, well, we'd like to colonize a new planet. We've junked ours. Yeah, we'll put you on the list somewhere down near the bottom. There's other people who would like that planet too. You know?
Yeah. All right. Thanks if you read it. Thank you for your super chat. Maybe we don't see Dyson spheres anywhere because it is seen as a threatening weapon, saying that we can attack you with a gamma ray and get attacked.
I think the problem there is that an advanced civilization has so many weapons that, you know, I mean, you just kind of go with that. It's we talk about in Hidden Alien Civilizations episodes why you, if you want to be left to yourself, you actually put up beacons saying, here we are. Right, because you don't want people to just stumble your territory, because that's going to cause you problems. You can't just go blow people's ships up. Eventually, someone's going to send an investigatory fleet, and it might be an armada that's heavily armed to say, what did you do to all ships, right? The best way to keep people off your land is pass no trespassing signs and keep off my lawn. And kind of the same way is people know what kind of weapons you got if you're a civilization that's ancient and powerful, and so there's no reason to hide that those might exist, especially when they're the base for your civilization. Someone looks at a Dyson sphere and they see a potential weapon. Well, if they look at New York City, they see a potential weapon, right? Because how many factories are in New York City? How much money, wealth, power, and influence and resource is done in New York City? You don't look at a city like that and say, oh, they're homeless, you know? It's like that old question, probably apocryphal with Joe Stalin, how many legions does the Pope have, or how many divisions? The answer is as many as he needs to grab. Same for a place like New York City. They got armed to the teeth pretty easily just by their assistance.
All right. We are wrapping up, so it is time for the lightning round.
Lightning
are you
round.
Ready?
All right. No, but go ahead.
No.
Anyway.
You don't want a lightning round?
Go ahead. See if we can get through some of them.
Vincent Cleaver, thank you for your $5 super chat. Happy anniversary.
Thank
See,
you.
That's an easy one.
And
more outward bound star system colonization episodes. Maybe pick a close brown dwarf, not a star.
I think we could do that. We know another colonizing brown dwarfs episode. And actually, if someone will send that to me afterwards so I can remember that, Sindri maybe, we will add colonizing brown dwarfs to the roster.
Cheers. Awesome guy says, whoops, it just went away. Well, somebody was having a comment and it just vanished. So if I find it again, I'll bring that one back up. Cerny Vitez, have you perhaps read Process Physics by Reginald Cahill, and could you share your thoughts?
I have not, so unfortunately I cannot, sorry.
Someone commented that pigs are clean animals, and that is definitely true.
Yeah, was it Sindri? He is.
It was not.
Okay.
Or at least, if it's so, it was under another name. Can you build a shell world around a star with both near-Earth gravity and livable temperatures?
Can you build a what?
Shell world around a star with
yes.
both near yeah. Earth gravity and livable temperatures.
It depends on what kind of star it is. Stars have a mass and a luminosity based on that mass that do not scale even a little bit. and so you have to get that right sweet spot. You can do it a lot easier with a white dwarf, right? Because it's a much lower luminosity. So basically, your options are red dwarfs and white dwarfs. You can't do it around our own sun too hot for its mass.
Bert Fisher says, is that a joystick to the right of you, Isaac?
It actually is, yes. I've been getting way less uses of that joystick of late than I should.
And a few other people want to know how the flying lessons are coming.
Appropriate question. We actually, our instructor is probably still in Florida. Is he back
yet? I think so. He went to the
some convention aviation, convention. Yeah. So a little behind on that right now. Sarah's still way better at than I am.
I guess that's a good thing, but we've had a few people jumping in with happy anniversary. Thank you.
Thank you.
And I think I'm finally finding where that question was before we jumped off of it there. All right. It was, what do you think the ratio between gas giants and terrestrial planets is in the universe?
Terrestrials are very, actually, now that I think about it, gas giant is also a very vague term. I'm going to assume, based on our corona sample, we have four terrestrial and four gas giants, depending on how we want to define them, that they're going to be a roughly even mix, plus or minus an order of magnitude. So I'm going to go out there on a limb and say that gas giants will not outnumber terrestrial planets by more than 10 to 1, nor terrestrial planets outnumber gas giants by more than 10 to 1.
Okay. Would the nuclear bomb be the equivalent of a galactic weapon that keeps the peace with mutually assured destruction?
I think a key thing, and for those of us kind of grew up during the Cold War, we all have more different viewpoints on this, but mutually assured destruction is not a new concept. It's just, it got tagged in there for the Cold War. Civilizations, when they are numerous, not a them versus us binary situation where we have lots of them, all exist in a state where they could really severely wound or cripple each other if they are willing to throw everything they had at somebody but leave them exposed and weak to other people. And that is that mutually assured destruction concept, as it shows back up in previous civilizations before nuclear bombs. You don't have to have a doomsday weapon individually to make people feel that way, but once you get to a certain level of technology, it still works. You know, nuclear bombs are still incredibly potent weapons at the interstellar scale. It's all about where you're hitting with them. You know, maybe you can blow one up with an O'Neill cylinder. Well, an O'Neill cylinder as a manufacturing center can probably build thousands of them. So if you might need a trillion of them to blow up a Dyson swarm, well, you've got a quadrillion on hand, you know?
This is a lightning round.
Okay. Faster answers what you're telling me.
Correct. Scott Ferguson says, within the simulation hypothesis, envisioning our own capability to create these simulations in the future, do you think that simulators implement limitations to stop us from creating our own simulations?
Possibly. And actually, that's the point I did not cover in our upcoming simulation hypothesis relook episode. I'm not going to use the word reboot because it's different material. But I'd say that would make a lot of sense, except it's a bit of a giveaway, right? You have to make them think it would be impossible to try, and then they look into it, they find they can't do it when they expect they should be able to do it. Could be a hint. You kind of want to set things up so it looks like it's impossible from the get-go.
Ramook says, do you consider it possible that life is so uncommon that we might never encounter naturally occurring aliens?
I hope not. I'd like to think that the universe has a lot of at least simple life in all galaxy. That's why I'm keeping my fingers crossed for planets covered in algae and simple organisms. It's a big universe, you know. It's a big universe. I hope we can find something else in there to at least find at the animal stage. But we'll see. That's the big thing. We'll have to find out.
Phil Spooner says, Isaac, what would be the ideal physical body for an uploaded consciousness or an AI? A normal robot like today's, or some sort of soft robot, or a body made of claytronics?
Claytronics, probably, but I could never quite get over the idea of having like a spider tank chassis with, you know, big Gatling guns on the shoulders.
Did you just say spider?
Spider tank chassis,
no,
yes.
No spider.
No.
No. Can you please rethink that?
Next.
I'm having you rethink that.
A non-spider, it's like a six-legged one instead of like eight.
That's just as bad. Okay. That's a mosquito.
A non-bipedal chassis.
I don't think we got to this one earlier. What do you think of the Janus model, and how would it allow faster than light travel through what amounts to hyperspace but without requiring negative energy or exotic matter?
What was the name again?
J-A-N-U-S.
Oh, Janus. See our hyperspace episode, because I'm not going to be able to give you details on that in a short period of time. Next.
Stop. Do you think that flying cars will have loud muffler customizations and other annoying accessories like we see in cars today, or showing off accessories depending on who's asking.
So the hyperspace one, I actually don't think it will work, though it's a nice idea. For the ones, I used to live in a resort town before we moved out here to the farm, and during the summer, motorcycles would go by the hundreds at a time, because we had a big motorcycle rally that would take place there, very good for the local economy. And of course, I always found myself wondering, why don't people put a muffler on this giant machine? And of course, the answer that I find myself thinking is because they would like to make it even louder. So yes, the answer would be yes.
Or like when my younger brother pulls in the driveway and you're like, man, that truck is loud. And he's like, do you like it? I was trying to amp it up a little bit.
Yes.
Morningstar says, just wanted to say hi and I love your work. You put everything so simple that even a former sailor can understand. Keep doing what you're doing.
Thank you very much.
Albert Jackinson, hello from California.
Hi, Albert. Good to hear from you again.
Shogun, love from Russia.
Thank you.
Someone says, hey from Ukraine.
Thank you, too.
Airplane for starring Isaac and his co-pilot.
Thank you.
I think that I've gotten through the majority of the questions here. I was just looking to make sure because it jumped a couple times and I thought we skipped a few. But
I think, was it given the existence of extremophiles?
Okay.
There we go. I got them up on another screen. For some reason,
yes,
it's locked up.
You can read that one. Can you read that
my
one?
My screen's locked up, actually.
Okay, I'll read that one to you. Yeah. That was a super chat from Christian Corello. Mm-hmm. Given the existence of extremophiles like Deinococcus radiodurans and solar flares from red dwarfs apparently erupting from their poles, does that boost the chances of life on Proxima Centauri B?
Wow. So weirdly, my screen is locked up. I'm going to have to keep it on Sarah for the moment, and I guess it's probably a good sign to stop. I like the idea that extremophiles will be available to us on red dwarf planets. I think people terribly misunderestimate the probability of red dwarfs hosting life, and I have all been too tightly locked to. I think we'll find that red dwarf planets have lots of simple life on them, and I think we'll see extremophiles that are doing even weirder things than we've already found. So extremophiles are the kind of the thumbing of the nose of those who assume that life had a really thin, narrow spectrum it could survive into. And so on that note, with the idea of Isaac saying that alien life might be a lot more common than we've previously indicated, although probably very simple alien life, we'll go ahead and close out. So I'm not, can't wave the screen because it's not showing up on me, but
okay, I'll wave for you. Me and you. Bye. So,
thank you for 2 years of my wonderful co-host here, Sarah Fellauthor, and we will see you in May live from the International Space Development Conference.